rap just don't do that same route, where they take the rawness away. Just didn't make it too pretty.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual fall membership drive. You can help us meet our $55,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $14,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give.
Can't get enough of The Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our entire first season, now streaming wherever you choose to listen to your podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe.
While you're at it, check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com so that we can keep you up to date on all the latest with The Ghost of Hollywood.
Whenever we're in Portland, we always try to put in at least 5 or 6 hours at KBOO,
right?
Because we're
the Fire Sign Theater.
So listen to 90.7 FM for
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll examine Israel's war of retaliation against Hamas and the people of Gaza through the lens of international law. Dr. Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, will be my guest. Then economist Marjorie Kelly joins me to discuss her new book, Wealth Supremacy: How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The Israeli army has issued evacuation orders to people living in northern Gaza, demanding that they immediately relocate to southern Gaza in anticipation of a deadly ground escalation of war. Israel's latest war is in retaliation for a series of attacks by Hamas aimed at Israeli civilians that killed well over 1,000 people and trapped about 100 hostages. So far, Israel's air attacks on Gaza have been indiscriminate, appearing to target civilians as well. Over the weekend, there were mass protests in cities around the world supporting Palestinian rights. Today, we'll examine what's unfolding in Israel and Gaza through the lens of international law with my guest, Dr. Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he was the founding coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and strategic nonviolent action. And he also serves as the associate editor of Peace Review and a contributing editor of Tikkun. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Great to be with you again.
You know, just when talking about and writing about this issue as I was preparing for our interview, I had to figure out what to just call it, right? Because we think about it, the mainstream media calls it a conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But that really obscures what is happening. How do we even find the language to explain what's happening in Israel and the occupied territories right now without falling into a trap that legitimizes, you know, the kind of approach that the mainstream media often takes and does away with historical facts?
It's difficult. I mean, in the mainstream lexicon and in what is generally recognized, the word terrorism is only applied to irregular groups. And there's no question, of course, about the horrific attacks by Hamas that killed at least 1,300 Israeli civilians were terrorism. To describe, or at least one that is commonly accepted, to describe what Israel is doing right now, which is as of this interview, you know, has killed probably twice that many civilians, with a death toll that's only going to rise. In fact, if you look at the numbers of Palestinians killed by Israeli bombing in Gaza since 2008, and the number of Israelis killed as a result of Hamas rockets and the like between 2008 and up until, I guess, here, the ratio is 20 to 1. 20 times more Palestinian civilians have died than Israelis have died. And yet we generally see only the Israeli deaths as a result of terrorism. Now, some people argue that Israel is not deliberately attacking civilians. There have been conflicting reports on that. I believe in some cases they indeed have, but in any case, in international law, you cannot indiscriminately bomb an area. I mean, manslaughter may not be as bad as murder, but it's still a crime. And especially if you have a ratio of 20 to 1, it's hard for Israel to assert moral superiority over Hamas. But again, there's not a generally accepted word to call that is used in lexicon about what Israel is doing.
Didn't Israel say that it would basically not be using precision-guided bombing? And when you're doing that in a place that's so densely populated as Gaza, it's basically saying, if you get bombed, it's because you didn't get out of our way.
Exactly. Declaring free fire zones, essentially what the United States did to large swaths of rural Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And something we've seen in a lot of kind of counterinsurgency wars, and that is a war crime. There's no question about it. You cannot demand that that civilians, especially what Israel's doing now, it's like a million people have to leave their homes. Apparently because Israel's planning to occupy that area. I mean, that's ethnic cleansing, frankly, and. It's also, and also just logistically, I mean, we've had people fleeing, and only to have Israel bomb these fleeing vehicles, you know. So there's no, you know, legal or moral justification for this, and you know, again, even if there are Hamas fighters somewhere in the neighborhood, you don't go blowing up entire apartment blocks. And this idea that Israel, echoed by U.S. officials and many in the mainstream media, that they're only targeting Hamas military concentrations, but there's no way Hamas has offices and military facilities in the many hundreds of buildings, residential buildings, that are being destroyed right now.
There are also reports that Israel is using white phosphorus. The Washington Post reported it, and there's a lot of images of white phosphorus having this very distinct signature that makes it very clear to and easy to identify. And that's also, you know, sort of akin to cluster bombs. It is the kind of weapon that has been widely condemned, hasn't it, as being indiscriminate and incredibly...
Yes, and it is considered illegal, and back by some definitions, it could even be considered a chemical weapon. But the United States also used it somewhat in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but Israel's been quite notorious in using it in attacks against both Lebanon and Gaza, and most recent attacks. It is a pretty horrific and indiscriminate weapon.
Now, if just looking at the reporting around what's happening in the area, if we want to think about international law as it applies here, if Israel can control Gaza's water and land and borders, you know, it's issuing evacuation orders, but it's closing borders, Israel essentially controls entry points into Gaza and it controls Gaza's resources. That in and of itself is indicative of such a power balance that you can't really call this a conflict, right?
Really, really. And here's a crazy thing. You hear people say, oh, Israel withdrew from Gaza. They're not occupying it anymore. But by international law, if you're controlling all the movement in and out of a certain area, and you can control the electricity and shipments of water and food and medical supplies and everything is under control, that is still legally speaking an occupation. And and again, the asymmetry in the conflict is so extraordinary. It's really hard to see it in terms of a traditional war.
The settlements as well that have been the Israeli settlements, I should say. Again, I'm struggling with the language here. The Israeli settlements that were targeted by Hamas. And I do want to talk about Hamas's targeting as well. But those settlements, along with other Israeli settlements, weren't they deemed illegal by the United Nations?
Oh, yes. Israel's been colonizing the West Bank and Greater East Jerusalem ever since Israel seized the territory in the 1967 war. The transfer of civilian population onto territories seized by a military force that are recognized as under foreign belligerent occupation is a direct violation of international humanitarian law. It's in the Fourth Geneva Convention, and its application to the Gaza Strip, its application to the West Bank, the no more settlements in Gaza Strip since 2005, but they're still in the occupied West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Golan Heights. That these are specifically recognized by the United Nations Security Council as illegal. And there have been, what's really upsetting a lot of Israelis, I know, is the people wonder, how is Hamas able just to sweep into these towns and kibbutzim and slaughter all these people so easily? And it's because Netanyahu sent the Gaza Brigade, which is the branch of the Israeli Defense Forces, which is primarily responsible for guarding that area, to the occupied West Bank to defend the Hawira settlement, a far right-wing settlement, along with 22 other battalions of the Israeli Armed Forces. In other words, Netanyahu is more concerned about protecting these illegal right-wing settlements and enforcing apartheid on the West Bank than he was protecting the border with Gaza, where most of the victims, ironically, were left-wing kibbutzim and kibbutzniks and ravers. And so, as with 9/11, people were so horrified by the attacks themselves and what followed, people are largely overlooking the incredible intelligence and other strategic failures by the government in power at the time. But the far right settler militia, largely with impunity from the Israeli occupation forces, have been terrorizing Palestinian villages, burning orchards and vineyards, burning down houses, shooting people, and the Israeli government insists that they're not responsible for this. But it's in many ways it's similar. Salvador and other Latin American countries during the 1980s, that they are doing so in direct cooperation with the government and the military. So, and you know, Hamas warned that if these kind of provocations continued, including violations of Islamic holy places in East Jerusalem and elsewhere, they would strike out, and sure enough they did, though no one imagined they could do it with the with the horrific consequences that took place.
You brought up September 11th, and I think that's a really important analogy and a useful analogy. In September 11th, 2001, when the United States was attacked by a group of fundamentalist militants who had their own reasoning for why they did what they did, but, you know, clearly in attacking civilians, they violated international laws. The United States got put on, by President George W. Bush, got put on a trajectory that lasted decades and that destroyed, you know, to some extent, civil liberties here in the United States, but much more importantly, untold numbers of lives, governments and institutions in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and that damage continues. And so many have sort of been pointing out that applying that this to Israel and the October 7th, 2023 attacks as being Israel's 9/11 is a way to look at it, because yes, what Hamas did was absolutely horrific, but is it going to set Israel on a trajectory in Gaza that is like the US's version of what happened? Although yeah, that, you know, yes, go ahead.
Even putting aside the moral implications of what Israel's doing strategically, I really don't see how it's going to work. I mean, this kind of force, I mean, it just breeds terrorism. And Israel is already going in an extremely far right direction. These overtly racist ministers in very powerful positions. Israel totally ruling out the idea of even a Palestinian mini state alongside Israel. I mean, the psychological damage has been huge. I mean, fortunately, this is greater than 9/11 in terms of the Israelis, and of course, For Jews, you know, who've been persecuted, you know, throughout the centuries, and Israel, which has been the victim of smaller terrorist attacks, but still horrific ones going back for many decades, you can imagine how triggering this might be. And people, when they're frightened, will tend to rally around the flag and support all sorts of awful reactions. I mean, it's amazing the way we had even relatively intelligent, center-left Democrats supporting the idea of invading Iraq. I mean, which is a clear violation. It's doing what, you know, 90% of American Middle East scholars, 80% of international relations scholars, and every mainline church in the country opposed, but they said, no, we're going to support Bush in this. And similarly, you see a lot of the more, liberal parties in Israel creating this unity government with Netanyahu and these far-right people at the helm supporting the attacks on Gaza. So this is what's very, very frightening is not just the horror of the attacks itself and the psychological impact on the people, which is even worse in Israel, I'd say, than in the United States, but also in the kind of reaction that's going to take place. Similarly, it could be proportionally even worse.
Let's talk about Hamas's actions. You mentioned that they basically warned that they would retaliate if Israel attacked in particular holy sites, which Israel has done. But from Hamas's point of view, for those especially who hold all of Gaza responsible for Hamas's actions, how do you explain what it was that they were trying to achieve by what they did on October 7th?
Well, if you first of all, I might look at the origins of Hamas. So they are only a tiny minority of had Palestinian support. I think at the time the Oslo Agreement was signed, maybe just 15% of Palestinian support. But the Fatah, the PLO, the mainstream Palestinian nationalist group for secular in orientation, signed this agreement. Recognize Israel and will accept a Palestinian mini state on only 22% of the territory, and we will give up the armed struggle. And Hamas thought, you guys are naive. Israel's never going to let you do that, especially since the United States is the chief military, economic, and diplomatic supporter of Israel, is also the sole mediator of the negotiations. And sure enough, the Palestinians saw the number of settlers doubled and triple, more and more land of their land confiscated, the settlements surrounding Palestinian population centers. So particularly as the Palestine Authority under the leadership of Arafat and Abbas proved increasingly corrupt and inept and assembling jailers in the Israeli prison of these little Palestinian enclaves surrounded by Israeli occupiers and settlers. The Hamas won a plurality in the 2006 Palestinian parliamentary elections, and they ended up sharing governance with the Fatah and the more moderate elements. The Bush administration pushed Fatah to stage a coup to push Hamas out. Hamas got wind of it, and they had a three-day civil war, and Hamas ended up in sole control of the Gaza Strip, banning all opposition and imposing authoritarian rule. And since then, the situation worsening in the West Bank, they became the vanguard of the Palestinian resistance, even though they're a horrifically reactionary, violent, ultra-conservative, fundamentalist kind of group. And I think this attack on Israel was sort of a way of saying, hey, Israel, you can't pretend that just because and you control the movement of Palestinians and everything else, that you're going to be safe. That until Palestinians have their rights, you cannot rest easy. Now, of course, unlike the most Palestinian groups who support a two-state solution or a binational state, one state with equal rights for all, Hamas, of course, wants to impose a reactionary Islamic theocracy, and Jewish people would be in danger in that kind of thing, as well as many Palestinian Christians, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I think it is a sign that the incredible frustration that the years of moderation by the majority Palestinian leadership has just made things worse.
Now, the situation with Israel trying to control its borders is another thing that has been laid bare, right? Israel spent a huge amount of resources creating this Iron Dome system to protect itself, and Hamas, I guess, proved that...
If
people are desperate enough, there's nothing that you can stop.
Right, exactly, from being exactly. And just a minute, let me say that the strategic analyst for years has been saying the Iron Dome would not work against a swarm attack, which is indeed what happened in terms of the rockets. And as I mentioned, because Netanyahu had sent the troops to the West Bank instead of outside of Israel, instead of inside Israel protecting it, Hamas was ready. And now, of course, Israel is just totally attacking, destroying Gaza. And if I may interject something here, we keep hearing this line about Hamas using human shields. We've heard this during the previous wars between Hamas and Israel. But in thorough investigations by the United Nations, by Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty International, have found no evidence of Hamas using human shields as defined by international laws, forcing people against their will, to be essentially be a deterrent to attacks. They did find that some Hamas fighters were closer to civilians than they should have been, but that's a lesser crime. That's not human shields. And similarly, except for the Israeli hostages, which I think really could be considered human shields, the thousands of Palestinian deaths we've seen in the past week or so, I've seen no evidence that any of them were a result of human shields. And yet you hear Biden and again saying, oh, Hamas is using human shields, therefore they're responsible for the deaths. But there's no evidence they are actually doing that. And even if they were using human shields, Protocol 1 of the Fourth Geneva Convention is very clear that does not absolve the attacking party of responsibility for their deaths. I mean, if there was a botched bank robbery and the bad guys are holding tellers and customers hostage, and they're shooting out into the streets, you wouldn't have the SWAT team come down and gun down everybody, including the hostages, and say, oh, it's not our fault, it's theirs, because they used human shields. You know, and so this and so that I really am upset that you people are uncritically using this line when, again, there's not only is there no evidence that's going on, but even if there was, that doesn't mean Israel is somehow allowed to commit war crimes. One thing that's kind of interesting is as during after I think it was the 2014 war, a Congress under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi resolution, which essentially redefined human shields, is saying Hamas is using human shields by embedding their fighters and officials in civilian neighborhoods, civilian mosques, civilian hospitals. But again, that's not the definition of human shields. And Hamas is in addition to being a terrorist group, is a quasi-governmental authority.
Right.
Hamas officials live in civilian neighborhoods, go to community houses of worship, go to community hospitals. And similarly, Hamas fighters, this is a militia, they also live at home and go to regular hospitals and houses of worship. So by redefining human shields the way that this huge bipartisan majority of Congress did, they're essentially saying that Gaza Strip is a free fire zone. And it's a very, very dangerous reinterpretation of international humanitarian law, has been denounced by virtually every scholar in that field that I know.
Al Jazeera on Monday is reporting that more than 1,000 of the Palestinians already killed in Gaza since October 7th are children. So you've already seen a sort of evening of the scales, if you will, within just a few days, and this is before Israel launches a ground war. How concerned are you about the dehumanization of Palestinians by not just Israeli officials, but American officials as well?
Yeah, I mean, those of us on social media and elsewhere have just seen these heart-rending photos of these Israeli families and children and others, you know, grandmothers, babies, you know, who are killed or kidnapped. But because Israel's cut off electricity and internet and everything else, we're not seeing similarly heart rendering photos of Palestinian families who are being killed. And I think a lot of it, frankly, is I think underlying racism that we see. I mean, it's a narrative we've seen, and those 19th century etchings of these Indian massacres of these pioneer villages, and the Mau Mau terrorist in Kenya, the FLN terrorist in Algeria, that no, there's no justification for killing civilians, even when resisting colonialism. But to overlook the colonialism itself, to overlook the far larger scale massacres of civilians, of indigenous peoples, by conquerors. I mean, we're seeing a similar dynamic here. And I think it's a real to rationalize and try to justify Hamas terror, while at the same time, and not say, oh, it's anti-colonial resistance, therefore it's okay. No, it's not okay to kill civilians, even in anti-colonial resistance. And similarly, I don't think but it's also equally important that we do not try to therefore justify the massive killings that we're seeing right now by Israeli forces. And I think that's the fundamental thing. We can argue about the origins of the conflict, how much is Zionism, colonial settler movement, how much of it's a national liberation struggle and oppressed people. We can talk about missed opportunities for peace by both sides. We can talk about all sorts of things about this. But the bottom line is you do not kill civilians, whether it be a terrorist with a gun or a jet fighter with white phosphorus.
Stephen, I'm wondering if you saw the op-ed in, or actually it was the editorial board of the New York Times on October 14th, published a piece, an opinion piece called Israel Can Defend Itself and Uphold Its Values. And the image on that to me, just spoke 1,000 words. For our radio audience, it's basically an image of probably a mother and a child in Gaza, and a hand, a blue cartoon hand covering the top of her head as she holds her child. And the whole piece goes on to talk about how Israel basically should be merciful in trying to destroy Hamas. It shouldn't damage its own reputation. Just sort of speaks of an Orientalist approach to saving the defenseless women and children in Gaza who are being held hostage by Hamas terrorists. It reminds me of the language that we saw here in the United States about the war in Afghanistan, you know, protecting Afghan women from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Is that what you get as well?
Yeah, I noticed that too. I mean, at least they're saying that Israel, you know, shouldn't bomb with impunity, as other folks have been saying. So in one weird sense, that's progress from the New York Times, which used to give a total blank check to Israeli actions, you know, some decades ago. So at least there's a little bit of nuance. But again, I think we are missing the the fact that if you look at the conflict, I mean, the very fact that Gaza already consists primarily of refugees and descendants of refugees who were ethnically cleansed during the creation of Israel in 1947-49 period. And this idea that, oh, all these Palestinians, you know, should leave Palestine altogether, Gaza Strip, if the Egyptians would let them out, which so far they haven't. You know, if Israel does move in there, will they allow them back even? Well, again, this just be a continuation of the Nakba, you know, catastrophic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And so, you know, it's really important to see the broader context of the conflict, of the apartheid type system that Israel has imposed. And while there's certainly a diversity among Israelis and Jews elsewhere who identify as Zionists, I don't think we shouldn't insist that Zionism is only its worst, most far-right elements. We also have to acknowledge that there is at least some degree of racism in the assumption of an ethnically identified state where people of that ethnicity or religion or whatever have privileges that others don't. And that underlying issue is in really, really what's driven the conflict and has led to these horrific chauvinistic that have emerged in reaction to that, and in certain ways have hijacked the Palestinian nationalist movement, which originally had called for a democratic secular state for all peoples. And for a time, even and still, at least officially, with the Palestine Authority and Fatah, a two-state solution with a Palestinian state on just 22% of historic Palestine, which, of course, the United States and Israel says is too much.
Finally, Stephen, what do you make of the incredible show of solidarity that we've seen internationally for Palestinians? There's been, for many decades, a movement building to support Palestinians, which, it should also be mentioned at the same time, there is very real anti-Semitism against Jews around the world, and we've seen that here in the United States. There's anti-Muslim sentiment as well. There was just, unfortunately, a 6-year-old Muslim child in Illinois who was killed in an alleged hate crime over the weekend, motivated apparently directly by Hamas's attack on Israel. So what are your thoughts on the ways in which we, the people around the world, are expressing solidarity for Palestinians, a movement that includes many, many peace-loving and justice-seeking Jewish people?
Very much so. And most of this actually has come from the Global South, which do see the see the Israeli-Palestinian struggle as a kind of anti-colonial struggle. In the West, we're seeing more and more solidarity of the Palestinians, especially among younger people who have tend to have a much greater awareness of institutionalized racism, which we saw manifested in Black Lives Matter, as well as indigenous rights. which has become more and more to the forefront. And of course, both of these, you know, lead younger people concerned about these issues to identify more with the Palestinians. Personally, I've been uncomfortable with some of the solidarity rallies, because some people have indeed tried to rationalize or even justify the Hamas attacks, and have not been, I think, as conscientious, aware of undercurrents of real anti-Semitism that's out there. But you know, by and large, I think the trend is towards a greater awareness and sympathy to the Palestinian narrative, which was virtually absent in public discourse, for in the West at least, for many decades. And my concern about just the Hamas terrorism and the Israel's terror bombing is that it might further polarize things, and make it more difficult to move forward, try to change U.S. policy, which has enabled Israel to do what it's been doing in recent decades. And I just really caution people to again express solidarity with the Palestinians in their struggle, but be careful who you make alliances with in the course of this struggle, to make sure there isn't anti-Semitism and rationalizations for terrorism and the like, which that not only is it morally objectionable to allow this kind of thing within the pro-Palestinian movement, but it really would end up hurting the cause, right, and make it more difficult to advance.
Stephen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your insight and analysis on this very, very profound issue. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, where he was the founding coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. And he is one of our go-to guests on Middle East policy and strategic nonviolent action. He is also an associate editor of Peace Review and a contributing editor of Tikkun. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, the racial justice editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The U.S. economic system is facing increasing scrutiny for the wealth inequality it has generated, and that continues to worsen. A significant part of the stranglehold that our current form of capitalism has is simply cultural. The idea that when stock prices are booming and the Dow Jones is high, the economy is healthy, and therefore ordinary Americans are thriving. But applying a clarifying lens to the prevailing economic model reveals that we live under a system of what my guest calls wealth supremacy. Marjorie Kelly is a distinguished fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit working to catalyze the creation of a democratic economy. She's a leading theorist in democratic economy design, and she joins me to discuss her latest book, Wealth Supremacy: How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. Welcome to the program, Marjorie.
Thanks, Sonali. I'm glad to be here.
So first, how do we define wealth supremacy? You know, I'm the racial justice editor at Yes Magazine, and so I talk often about white supremacy. Right. What is wealth supremacy? Is there an analogy, and is there even overlap with white supremacy?
Yes, there's definitely an analogy and an overlap. And it was deliberate when I chose this title, because I'm trying to show how similar they are. So wealth supremacy is the idea that wealthy people matter more than the rest of us. They deserve more power, they deserve more more comfort, more prosperity, and that's normal, and that's the way things should be. It's very similar to white supremacy. It's kind of the norms of society that can fall to the background and can seem acceptable until you point out that this is really bias and that it's not legitimate. And so that's what I'm trying to do here, is to say this really is a biased system. If you suspect that it's rigged against you, it is, and I show how. Yes, and the two do overlap a lot. I think people of color understand instinctively and intuitively that property of ownership is a concept that is can be weaponized and can be used against people. And that's a lot what's happening in this system of wealth supremacy.
Is it just cultural, or is it also built into the system? Well, let's talk about the systemic nature in which how our economic system is designed to privilege the wealthy. You know, I think many of us do know that. Even white people understand from a very instinctive level that the wealthier you are, the more loopholes you have, the more benefits you get through our tax system, through our, you know, through the economic models that the government has adopted, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's exactly right. Look at the 2008 meltdown, for example. Predatory mortgages from the big banks, and there was a big institutional investors and wealthy investors who supported this, you know, came in and basically took the equity out of people's homes through predatory mortgages. It was mostly often people of color who lost their homes, who were pushed into predatory mortgages when they could have qualified for regular mortgages. So that there we see racial inequity happening, but it's happening hand in hand with what I call capital bias or wealth supremacy. So, you know, these big banks, these big institutional investors, you know, if they can make money on racism, they will, but they aren't necessarily even aware of the racism involved. They just want the maximum returns. So yes, the two are entirely entwined.
So the economy is rigged. If you're wealthy, the more wealth you have, the more wealth you can make. Billionaires know this. Even those very, very few billionaires who try to give away their wealth end up accruing wealth faster than they can give it away, just because of the way the system is set up. And that's quite remarkable, right? And I'm wondering if you can also explain how our system has become perverted away from the sort of real nuts and bolts idea of what we think of as wealth. A home to most of us is wealth, but that's not how our system really defines it, right?
Yeah, so let's talk for a second, Sonali, about how the system is rigged. So what I do in my book, Wealth Supremacy, is I look at seven myths which really form the operating system of capitalism. And the first one is no amount of wealth is ever enough. That is the prime, it's the primary principle built into investing. You know, Bill Gates, at one point, the founder of Microsoft, at one point, he had $10 billion. That's, you could fund 100 dynasties that would last for generations with that. But what did he do? He invested, and 2 decades later, he had $300 billion. And so no amount of wealth is ever enough. You keep investing, you keep wanting more. That's one myth. Another is that workers are not members of the corporation. And this is how corporate governance is designed. It's only capital that has a vote inside the corporation. The board of directors is elected by capital. And the more wealth you have, the more votes you have. So right there, you see how capital is empowered. Whereas if labor wants to be empowered, they have to go out and organize shop by shop by shop. In a place like Starbucks, will have 1,800 shops, and so you have to organize 1,800 shops. Whereas capitalism is empowered automatically without a single fight required. So those are a couple of examples of how the myths that the system operates by and how it's rigged. And so you said. How has it gotten so out of out of whack. Well, I grew up in a family. My father ran a small business. My grandfather had a slightly larger business. We were never wealthy, but we had enough money. We lived on one salary. I was able to go to college without a lot of debt. And my mother was able to retire without having to work outside the home. There was no dynasty. There was no, you know, huge transfer of intergenerational wealth, but there was some cushion and some prosperity. That's how the system used to work, how it's supposed to work, and it doesn't anymore. I mean, even the middle class doesn't have assets. You have 2 out of 3 Americans lack even $1,000 to fall back on. I mean, Sonali, you and I could think of a million ways that you need $1,000. Your car breaks down, you have a kid who needs a band uniform, you know, maybe you want to take a little vacation or something. I mean, $1,000 is nothing. And yet people don't, 2 out of 3 don't even have that. Meanwhile, not only has the number of billionaires grown, which, you know, we hear about that a lot. But one of the things I look at in the book is how aggregate financial wealth has grown. So if you take all financial assets, stocks and bonds and debts of various kind, and you think of that as a sphere. So that used to be equal to GDP, which is gross domestic product. And that's like income and spending. So that's the real economy. People, you know, work jobs, they get money, they spend their money. That's the GDP. But meanwhile, there's this sphere of financial assets, which is now 5 times GDP. And it grows by extraction. It keeps it wanting to extract more and more and get bigger and bigger and bigger, because as we said, no amount of wealth is ever enough. And so in the aggregate, what we have now is a financialized capitalism. It's a new kind of capitalism. It's not about robber barons. It's not even about CEOs. It's about capital. And capital is on autopilot and trying to grow and get bigger. And it's become a destructive force, capturing government. Dark money is funding some of this hard right insanity that's happening. You have, you know, Exxon Mobil won't stop producing fossil fuels because it feels it has an obligation to its shareholders. And so on. So there are all kinds of forms of real devastation that are happening. Families loaded with debt, workers who their jobs have been turned into contingent, part-time, insecure jobs. 40% of jobs are now insecure and contingent in that way. And so all of this devastation is happening while these wealthy portfolios expand and expand and expand. And it's reached a point of real trouble and absurdity.
I want to get to the designing alternative models part of it and what you mean by a democratic economy. But just picking up on what you were talking about, this idea of fiduciary responsibility, and it's something that you write about. Tell me more about that. It's not something that we think about unless we're economists, we think about. But the fact that it is such a sort of considered a sacrosanct thing in our economy is a huge reason why we have a climate crisis and so much poverty and inequality, right?
It's really true. I thank you for pointing that one out. That's another of the myths that I point to. And a fiduciary duty, boy, you know, it sounds so benign. It sounds so technical. You know, you just want to, yawn. It's so boring. And fiduciary duty, what it means is, let's say that you or I has a little bit of assets, and so we turn it over to a mutual fund or an investment advisor. Well, that fund or advisor has an obligation to act in our behalf, right? That manager can't run off and invest the money in their crazy Uncle Harry, or they can't take the money and spend it on their own vacation in the Bahamas. You know, they have a fiduciary duty to take care of their client and act like it's their client's money and not their own. Well, that's fine, and that's necessary, and that's good. We all want that. It's pretty necessary and benign. But there's this other thing that's tucked inside fiduciary duty, and it's what I call capital bias. And it's this idea that only capital matters, which is another word for wealth, and nothing else matters. So if you're going out and trying to return good returns to your investor. If you trash the environment, if you devastate society, if you ruin the lives of tens of thousands of laborers, doesn't matter. It's not material. The only thing that matters is maximizing those gains for capital. So that capital bias that's tucked into fiduciary duty, that's the danger. And we don't see it because we're taught, oh, well, of course you have to, you know, be responsible in how you manage investments. Well, of course you do, but you don't have to pretend that nothing else in the world matters. And that's the problem.
So we have a constitution that determines and tells us that all people are created equal, and yet we have an economic system that says, no, if you're wealthy, then you matter more. How do we redesign our economic system to actually adhere to the tenets of a liberal democracy?
So a society half democratic and half plutocratic is not going to endure. And that's what we have right now. So one side or the other is going to take over, right? Either we're going to have plutocrats taking over the government, hamstringing politicians with, you know, political donations and lobbying by corporations. We're going to stop our ability to deal with climate change because ExxonMobil won't like it. So you can have plutocracy take over, and that's what happens in financialization. Or you can have democracy be suffused throughout society. So we have a democratic government and we have a democratic economy. That's what we're working for, the democracy collaborative. And I have been tracking this as a journalist and a theorist and a consultant for really three decades now, Sonali. And I've written for Yes Magazine. Yes Magazine is one of the wonderful outlets that is promoting a democratic economy and various models. So what does it mean? So we have an extractive economy, which we have now, or you have a democratic economy, right? So an extractive economy is designed to extract maximum wealth for the few. It's about extracting financial wealth. Well, a democratic economy is designed to serve all of us, and to help us all prosper and have lives of dignity and freedom, and to have a living earth, a sustainable earth, because of course you can't have lives of dignity and meaning when ecological devastation is all around us. So how do you design that? First of all, it's about what do we care about? Social institutions are really designed around our values, right? Democracy is about, you know, liberty and equality and justice. Well, a democratic economy is about those things. It's also about fairness. It's about sustainability. It's about community. And people instinctively care about these values. These are things that we care about. And so how do you design for community? Well, for example, the community should own its own water. It should own electricity. And there are 85% of Americans who right now, we get our water from municipally owned utilities, city owned, county owned. This is government ownership, right? We're taught to fear government ownership as though it's communism, but that's absurd. That's just red baiting. You want public ownership of essential assets like water. Meanwhile, big capital is out there trying to buy water rights in Colorado and California. I open my book, Wealth Supremacy, with that very scary story. We're coming into a world of water shortages. And so who's going to be in control of water? Is it going to be big capital trying to make a ton of money on it? Or is it going to be communities who see water as a human right and that we all need to have access to water every single day? Every living creature does, not just humans. And so this is one of the big battlegrounds ahead is water. Electricity, there are municipally owned and cooperatively owned electricity in our country. And it's shown that there are lower rates and better service when it's owned cooperatively or by the community. 15% of forests worldwide are now controlled by indigenous communities or by community groups. And the UN has said that this model is vital to preserving ecological biodiversity. So you can have worker ownership of firms. There's 6,000 substantially worker-owned firms, including Recology in the Bay Area, which is a $1 billion company. And it's 100% owned by its workers. It serves communities up and down the West Coast. It has a mission of a world without waste. And it pays garbage truck drivers $100,000 a year, because if you're not extracting a lot of wealth for shareholders, there's more to go around for workers. Worker ownership. So you can also have community land trusts, which keep housing affordable. So there's state-owned banks, community-rooted banks. So there's a variety of models. They have the public good at their core, and they have broad-based ownership. Either workers, or you have farmer-owned cooperatives, or community-owned solar and water, and so on. So you want broad-based ownership, the public good at the core, and we need a great ownership transition. That's one great process that we need toward a democratic economy. And another is we need new forms of capital as well.
So it's not as though there's some never before thought of idea on how to make our economy more democratic. There's models that already exist, and it's a matter of changing the priorities and the systemic built-in biases of our economy. So to that end, how do we change our culture to help Americans be on board with this? First of all, reject the current system, and then be on board with redesigning the system. That it feels like we need a class consciousness that the U.S. unfortunately doesn't have, because we tend to all be aspirational billionaires, right? Or many of us think that we're just billionaires in waiting.
Yeah, you're right. I love what you said, that these models exist. They've been proven. It's not as though, I'm talking about some pie in the sky thing. And so we need a change of consciousness. One of the things I talk about in my book, Wealth Supremacy, is where do we start? How can we participate in this system change, really, is what we're talking about. And I say that the first thing we need to do is to talk to each other. Right? We need to read my book, read other books, read about these various models and get a little bit educated, talk to each other so that we give each other permission to think this way. The mainstream media isn't as much help as it should be. I mean, of course, you hope that this concept of wealth supremacy will catch on, and people will, that language maybe will help, or the democratic economy, that concept can help. But, I think back, Sonali, to the 70s and second wave feminism. And where do you start? Women were at their kitchen tables talking to each other, about their unease and about something didn't seem right, and recognizing that sexism was real, that male supremacy was real. People of color have helped us as a culture to understand that white supremacy is real. And so we need a similar kind of, almost like a kitchen table movement to say wealth supremacy is real. This is not hand waving. This is not ideological arguing. It's a real force in our society, and we need to see it. It's a force as big as climate change, and yet much more invisible. And I think once we see it, we'll be motivated to act. That's my hope.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Marjorie. Is there a website that you can share where people can find out more about the work you do?
Sure. Yes. I'm going to mention too, go to wealthsupremacy.org. And you'll see different things I've written there and learn about the book. And you can also go to democracycollaborative.org and learn about the organization where I work that's working to build a democratic economy.
Wonderful. We'll post links to both of those from our site. Thank you so much, Marjorie.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest has been Marjorie Kelly, a distinguished senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit working to catalyze the creation of a democratic economy. We've been discussing her new book, Wealth Supremacy, how the extractive economy and the biased rules of capitalism drive today's crises. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO's annual fall membership drive is just getting started, and now's a great time to become a member of KBOO. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 right now. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $14,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Join the KBOO family today and help us meet our $55,000 fall drive goal. All the cool kids are doing it.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country.